Welcome back to another episode of the Scared Stiff Horror Podcast. I am your host, Doug Plumatello, and today we have our special Christmas episode, part two. Joined with us again is Daylan Candy Cane Lane. How are you doing, Daylan?
Hello, everyone. So happy to be back.
Yes, it's good to have you back.
I got a new mic and everything. I feel very high tech right now that I'm on this fancy microphone.
Yeah, I was going to say you sound a lot better today. You cleared your throat out?
Yeah, it did.
So like your favorite sequel says, you'll be back. And here you are.
Forever. I will always come back to this show as long as you'll have me.
Sweet. Yeah, I had fun on last week's episode talking about P2 or Pedos and Better Watch Out.
Yeah. Still great films. Yeah. I hope that inspires people to watch them.
I hope you guys listening actually watch the movies first before we ruined it for you. Yeah. There's a couple of big spoilers in there.
Yeah.
So, but Tonight we have another treat for everyone. We're going to be discussing not one, not two, but three great Christmas horror movies.
Ooh, baby, I'm ready.
And today we are going to tackle Black Christmas, Black Christmas, and Black Christmas. 1974, 2006, and 2019 to be exact.
Look at you. You have all your facts straight.
Yeah. It's very interesting that Black Christmas never got a sequel, but got two remakes.
Yeah. I don't think any of them really need a proper sequel. They're pretty strong. All three of them, regardless of your feelings, very much handle their own. I really don't think any of them needed an official sequel, and I'm happy for that. I think the remakes were enough.
I'm really surprised, actually, that especially in the 80s, and at that point, Black Christmas was only 6 years old. I'm surprised it didn't get the franchise treatment.
So I have my own thoughts on why I don't think there was ever a sequel. Why do you think they never went ahead with an actual sequel for the 74 version?
That's a good question, especially in the 80s when some series went up to part eight, you know, and it was the craze. The first one made $4 million, which doesn't seem like a lot now, but you know, it's considered a hit back in 1974. It's a really good question. I don't know if it's a rights issue or maybe they just said the story was already told and it's not worth doing another one, but they stuck to their guns. Yeah, that's a really good question.
My thought is that it had a pretty good cast for back in the day, like especially with Olivia Hussey and whatnot. And I think that back then there really just wasn't a market for holiday movies, and still horror was frowned upon to a degree. And this was the original slasher. It was very, very violent. And so I could see them just after it came out, just being like, nah, I think we need a break from this.
Yeah, quite possibly. It was a few years later, but Silent Night, Deadly Night got a lot of bad publicity when that movie came out.
Yeah. And
maybe Hollywood was like, maybe let's hold off on Christmas horror movies. Well, who knows? Yeah. But you had 1980, you had Christmas Evil. So there were some Christmas horror movies, but that's a good question.
Yeah. And like I said, I think I mentioned this on last week's podcast that I was watching a film. Was it Christmas Twister or something? So it's like in the same vein as like Velocipastor and Llamageddon, but now it's Christmas Twister about a Christmas tornado.
Now I want to say there's possibly more Christmas horror movies than Halloween. So
yeah, there's a lot. You know?
But even the remakes didn't get sequels either.
No, but I'm happy about that. Yeah. Maybe you're upset about that.
We'll get there.
Yeah.
We'll get there.
just for all those listening, I think that this is going to be a very strong opinion on both sides episode.
Yeah. I don't think we're going to agree on a lot of this other than one of the films.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
So why don't we delve into it? So.
Okay.
Black Christmas. 1974, directed by Bob Clark, who also directed A Christmas Story about a decade later. Like you mentioned, it was starring Olivia Hussey, Margot Kidder, and John Saxon.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was actually had a different name at one point. At one point, the film was called Silent Night, Evil Night. And when it aired on TV, it was renamed A Stranger in the House.
Yes.
So that could be going back to what we were discussing with maybe people weren't comfortable at that point mixing horror and Christmas.
Could be. Yeah.
For those who haven't seen it, which if that's the case, pause our humble podcast and pop on Tubi where you could watch all three of these movies, but at least watch the first one before we ruin it for you.
Final correction, Tubi has the 74 and 2006 version, but it does not have the 2019
version. Oh, you're correct.
I think it was there, but they removed it. It's now on Netflix.
Netflix, yeah. So, yeah, thanks for the note. Definitely, yeah, you could, if you have Netflix and Tubi, you could check out all three of these films.
Yeah.
At least watch one of them.
Yeah. Probably the first, like, if you really, you know, before we kind of dive in, I think, and I don't know if you do agree with this, but I really think the first one is so worthwhile. And if you are a horror fan, this is a foundational film for the slasher genre of horror. So this is a really pivotal moment in, I think, you know, film history. And it's also really a good film. It's a little bit, it feels a little bit long, but it's a good film.
Quick synopsis on the film. It takes place in a sorority house. And there's a bunch of sorority sisters who are about to go on break. And they've been getting phone calls from someone called, they call the Moaner. And it's someone who is yelling obscenities into the phone and disturbing messages. And that's where we start off. And it begins with one of the sorority sisters getting killed. And she disappears. And so it becomes a mystery. What happened to this girl? Where did she go? Her father comes to pick her up. And that's when they realize that she actually is missing and she didn't go home early. Her dad comes to pick her up and they realize, wait, where is she? Why? How is she missing? What we see happen, though, is she was killed and she was brought up. She was suffocated with a plastic bag, which becomes a recurring kill in the franchise. And she's thrown up into the attic. Interesting factoid, that actress was actually a swimmer. And so when you see her face wrapped up in plastic and she's in the attic, it's not a dummy. She's actually holding her breath, which is pretty impressive.
Oh, that's such a good tip. Whoa, I didn't know that.
Yeah, because I every time I see these movies or somebody that's supposed to be dead, I'm always looking at their chest, always looking at their neck to look for little signs of breathing. And there's none on her, which makes you think it could be a dummy. But no, she's actually holding her breath.
She's also, for someone who is killed in the film and so early on, she's in this unique position. She kind of stays in the film, like, until almost the end. You see her pop up several times. So she has a very cool death, but then also manages to actually stay in the film, which is awesome.
Yeah. So we have a little mystery. They have John Saxon, who people would later know from Nightmare on Elm Street. He is, once again, the cop. And they're trying to find out what's happened to this girl. You know, where did she go? So as the girls get these phone calls, we start hearing different voices on the phone. You have the character who ends up being Billy, who is the killer. You're hearing stories about Agnes. You're hearing stories about the mom. But you don't really know. Is this multiple people? Is this one person? It's a mystery that unravels as the movie continues. Okay, as the story progresses and the girls and the police officers are trying to figure out who this is, they find out the calls are coming from the house. And it turns out the character Billy has been living in the attic and living in the walls. And that's how he's been picking out the victims. So it's very creepy.
It's so smart. It's such a smart plot because I feel like as a viewer, and I've watched this film a number of times, I'm sure you have as well. And I feel like every single time I watch this film, even though I know, and you kind of do get the gist that this character is living in the house quite quickly on, but it's still such a good shock. The way that they present that he's living in the house. And I feel like if you're a millennial like us, it's interesting. But for any younger person watching this film, there's a whole entire scene where they're trying to figure out how to trace the call. So they actually, you see like in the police department, someone is really monitoring all the wires and connections that the phone service provides because they're tracing and tracking the callers that are coming into the sorority house. And when it's finally captured, they then have to call the sisters and let them know. And I just feel like, I don't know, there's something really nostalgic and very cool about how this is done, but also so unsettling how it you know, ultimately gets found out.
Yeah. Another interesting Christmas story fact is that gentleman who was trying to track the phone calls was the Christmas tree salesman in the Christmas story.
Oh.
Well, there's two connections here, the director and then the Christmas tree guy.
That's cool.
There's also a red herring that they introduce in the form of the boyfriend, Peter, which is who the girls and the police officers end up thinking is the killer. Because we don't see Peter and the killer at the same time or hear the killer's voice and see Peter in the same shot.
I'm curious. I definitely never got the vibe that he was the killer, ever. And I think that's because, so there's a sub story in this that happens where Olivia Hussey's character, she is pregnant and she wants to get an abortion, and Peter becomes extremely emotional about this and does like refuses to let her get the abortion. And this is a really important subplot, even though it doesn't necessarily relate to the overall plot of the film. It's, you know, like character studies, right? But from that moment, I just knew he is not involved in this. Like, there's no way he wouldn't care. He wouldn't care.
Well, there's the scene when Peter freaks out, you know, he's upset about the baby and he doesn't get into the school he was auditioning for. And he starts smashing the piano, which is a key moment because later on in the film, when Billy is calling and he's in the walls, you hear that piano being smashed as part of the soundtrack, which subliminally might be trying to connect Peter to the killer. But then there's another line when Peter and Jess, they have the conversation about keeping the baby, which no one else would have heard. When another phone call comes in, Billy repeats something about killing the baby. And so that's why
it's word for word.
Yeah. So she thinks it's Peter.
Yeah.
And the audience at the time may have thought this was Peter. And so moving to the end, here comes the big spoiler. Jess is actually the one that kills Peter. They're the last two in the house. She's the final girl. And she kills him. And the police find Peter dead in Jess's arms. And then, you know, they put her in bed and everyone says, okay, this is over now. We got him. They leave Jess alone in the house. And we pull back to reveal she's now alone in the house, but Billy's still there. So assumingly she gets it after the credits roll.
Yeah. I would like to believe that she doesn't, but she probably does.
Most likely. So the strengths of this film, there was a lot of nuance to these characters. I found all the characters, Margot Kidder's character, they all had a unique aspect to them. You know, she was suffering from alcoholism. You know, her parents didn't want her to come home. Each girl had something that they were, a real world issue they were facing. You know, and in the abortion is actually a very interesting aspect because Roe vs. Wade was January of 73 and this movie came out December 74. So it was like a new hot issue when this film used it as like a subplot, some context to the argument between Peter and Jess. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah. And even when Jess also kills Peter, just for further context for those who are okay with spoilers and, you know, haven't seen the film, she doesn't just murder him. She makes her way down after being chased by Billy, and she makes her way down into the basement. And there, all of a sudden, Peter kind of pops up and wants to, quote unquote, help her figure out, like, what's going on, because she's very distraught and upset. And she mistakes him for the killer. And I feel like, yeah, there's this interesting emotional layer to the baby discussion, their relationship discussion. It's just, there's an importance to it. And that she kind of loses herself along the way. And that's exactly what she was trying to save. So I just, I love this film.
Yeah. It was a masterclass of subtlety and suspense.
Yes. And I love, and the reason why I'm bringing this up is because this does correlate to the 2019 version. So I don't want to forget this thought. There's such an awesome shot of Billy right before, as Jess notices that he's in the house, because it's some, you know, he does move around and you kind of assume he's moving around. That's how he's killing people. He doesn't just remain in the attic. But there's this shot of him behind her bedroom door and you just see his eye, but it's like a almost like a red colored eye. And this, it's like a little Easter egg nod to it in the 2019 version. And I just think that shot is also so unsettling and creepy and maniacal. It's just such a good, solid shot.
Yeah, it goes to show you in 74's version, you really only see his eyeball and you see a silhouette, and that's all you see of Billy.
Yeah.
The rest is a lot of suggestion from the maniacal phone calls when he's in hysterics. Mm-hmm. And it shows you, they didn't really need to show you very much.
Yeah, and his hysterical voice, the voices that he conjures up, all the things that he says also, I'm genuinely surprised that some of it made it through. You know, again, in the early 70s, some of the things that he says, especially like in the first 10, 15 minutes, are so obscene, even to today's standards, but it's so good. It's just so, ugh. It still is like gives me goosebumps a little bit. It's so creepy.
Before we move on, there's another little cute reference they threw in that first movie. It takes place in Bedford Falls, which Christmas fans may recognize from the town in It's a Wonderful Life.
Yep.
A fun little nod.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, do yourself a favor if you haven't seen it. Although, if you haven't seen it, we just spoiled it for you. But still, check it out.
And maybe follow it up with It's a Wonderful Life if you need a palate cleanser.
Yeah, double feature.
Yeah.
Can't go wrong.
It's a great double feature, though. It's, you know what? It runs the gamut of making everyone happy.
The original Barbenheimer, right?
Exactly. What would we call this?
What would we call this? This mashup? It's a Wonderfully Black Christmas.
Okay. I guess that works. All right. It sounds a little bit not okay, but, you know, we'll allow it for today. Yeah,
that's a title that stands out.
Yeah.
Every time a bell rings, Billy gets his knife. Any other notes on this film before we move on to the first remake?
No. My favorite character in this whole film is Mrs. One. You would think my favorite character, I should know her name. Mrs. Mack, who is the house mother, which I actually don't even know if roles like this still exist in fraternities and sororities. And the equivalent in a fraternity, obviously. But she is my favorite, and she does pass along, but her role is so hilarious in this film and the little bit that she's in. And she has such a good, violent, fun death as well. I just love her. That's all I wanted to say.
The scene of her giving the dad the tour of the house and trying to cover the nudie posters. It's so good. Yeah. She's so great.
Also, I really thought that Mr. Harrison was maybe the killer. Every time I watch it, I'm still like, I don't know. I still think you could be the killer.
I wonder if he was a red herring, because he was very awkward. He was in so much of that movie and didn't say a thing. He was just there. So I wonder if he was supposed to be a red herring for that film. It's possible.
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. Weird guy.
Yeah.
One knock on Miss Mac, though. I don't care how thirsty I was. Would you ever drink right from the toilet? She had a bottle of, I don't know, Jack Daniels hidden in the...
Elijah Craig.
Okay. She pulled that right out of the toilet and drunk out of it, like, without even hesitating.
Look, desperate times call for desperate measures.
Yeah, she probably put up with a lot of stuff in that house.
Yeah. I don't think that I could hang, like, with her. I don't think I could party with her.
Yeah, she's a real party animal, that one.
Yeah.
So.
R.I.P. Mrs. Mack.
Yeah, R.I.P. So we move on to 2006, three decades pass, 32 years to be exact, before we got another Black Christmas. I sensed some hesitation on you. Let's start with you, Dalen. What are your thoughts on the 2006 version?
I'm already sighing because I know that we're going to disagree here, but damn it, what a wasted cast. What a terrible film. I hate this movie so much. I hated it the first time I watched it, and then rewatching it, oh man, it just felt like torture. And I think it's more so that I love so many of the players in this film and the cast, and I just feel like it's all wasted.
Before we get into it, I'll just mention, directed by Glenn Morgan, starring Michelle Trachtenberg, Lacey Chabert, and Mary Elizabeth Winstead. Yeah, I didn't mind it. I tell you, it actually, funny enough, it got better the more I watched it. It was not trying to be the 1974 Black Christmas.
I will give it that. Yeah, I agree.
It was a brutal film, but it was definitely a more like polished studio film. Bigger budget, you can tell. It looked beautiful. I tell you, the cinematography in that movie was beautiful. A lot of it was lit as if it was being lit from a Christmas light. So a lot of greens and reds, a lot of rich colors. You know, it definitely had a Christmas feel. It was snowing.
You know what? Okay, I'll give you that. I think also there are some really beautiful shots, and I am personally a fan of lights, all different colors of lights. I love them like a moth to the flame. But I think that that's maybe one of the few strengths of this film. I felt like a lot of the kills, or nearly every single kill, is repetitive. None of the kills felt particularly unique, separate from what happens in Billy's family. I know we're going to get into the you know, plot shortly, but again, I kind of wish that that Hollywood would remake this film with the same cast, just different plot.
Well, you mentioned the death. Another thing that I liked about the deaths is each death was done with another Christmas ornament. Either it was Christmas lights, it was that little unicorn, you had an icicle. They all had a thematic related death till Christmas. I thought that was kind of fun. You had the candy cane at the beginning. Billy sucked the candy cane till it was sharp and stabbed the security guard with it. That was kind of fun.
Like bags around the head, which I know that's a nod to the original, but there were multiple of them. Like, what are we doing?
So, of course, with the sequel or a reboot, remake, you know, sometimes they find the need to explain. In this movie, you might have over-explained the backstory in Billy, which in the original film, you never really figured out what was up with Billy. All you really heard were phone calls. And in this version, you know, you see Billy in full at the beginning, and you get not just one flashback, not just two flashbacks, but you get three flashbacks explaining his complicated story. And you find out that Billy was born with jaundice, so his mom locked him up in the attic.
He has extreme jaundice, so he's permanently yellow, but not like just already a sickly yellow. He's like from Sin City, you know, that character yellow. It's strange.
And his mom was not the mom of the year. No. So I believe she killed her husband.
Yep.
And then was having sex with her boyfriend, and he fell asleep before finishing. So
he's impotent. He also couldn't have kids.
Yeah. So she decided that, you know, she hadn't gotten her cookies yet. So she went upstairs and had sex with her son, Billy. And then we fast forward 9 years later, we find out that Agnes is not only Billy's sister, but is also his daughter.
Yep.
So quite the backstory on Billy, which in a way, his backstory, if you think about it, yes, he was the killer. He did kill these girls, but the backstories make him kind of sympathetic. This poor boy was locked in the attic.
Totally agreed. And this really, at least for me, fundamentally, is why I have an issue with the film. Because I really appreciate his backstory. I appreciate even how he chose to act as an adult, you know, like given all the trauma and whatnot, but just poorly executed, I think. And what did you mention before? Something about like too many details. It felt, and we have talked about this in the past too, too many details where there didn't need to be that level of detail, but then in other areas of the film where it probably could have been fleshed out a bit, it just wasn't.
Yeah, and I guess the filmmakers, they must have thought that to bring this movie back, they need to add something. And so they decided to kind of dig into Billy's character versus the first one. Yeah. He didn't hear much. It also was a very different movie. The first, like we mentioned, was a very creepy, dark, pretty much realistic movie. And this one felt Hollywood. It was, everything was bigger, it was brighter. But man, it was pretty brutal. They had some really brutal deaths in this movie.
I just wish that there had been... Okay. Did you really like any of the characters in this film? I think I also struggled to really like the characters. And actually, we'll say separate from Billy and his family, because that's very obvious how you're supposed to feel about everyone, I think. But in terms of the sorority members, none of them really felt very likable.
Well, you had similar issues. You had the one girl who was the alcoholic. This is where I did not realize until further watches that there's a lot more similarities with the original as far as the overall structure until I really broke it down. So in the first movie, you know, Jess is kind of the star, but in reality, she's the star because she was the one that always picked up the phone.
Well, she's the final girl, but she is also the one who is dealing with the emotional issues. So I think that's why everyone else is so secondary, because I don't know, you know, we'll get into this with the 2019 version where you do have more context around some of the girls, but I feel like Jess having a lot of the attention on her in the original makes sense, but really I don't feel like any of the girls had that much attention in the 2006 version. And that also made it hard to really relate to them, to feel for them.
And I think that was by design. What I'm thinking is that if there's not one character that stands up versus the others, that might have been intentional in the aspect that you don't know anybody could die next. Mm. That may have been a conscious choice.
Maybe. Yeah, I guess I could see that.
You had other characters. The dad character was kind of swapped with the sister who was coming back to pick up the girl who was the opening scene kill. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of that they kind of carried over into the remake. It was also a lot more secluded, this film. The majority of it was actually in the sorority house. You know, you open up in the hospital, and I want to say that the rest, hour and 15, we're in the house until we get back to the hospital at the end.
Yeah.
So.
There is a really awesome, I'll give it, there's a really awesome kill scene in the hospital the second time we're there with one of the sorority girls who ends up killing Agnes. And I will give her due. That's a really solid scene.
Again, in this film, another thing they carried over from the original are the red herrings. This time you had two. You had Kyle, who was the boyfriend. Mm-hmm. And once again, Kyle repeats some of the words that they hear on the phone. But you're my family now.
Yep.
Which is a line that we recognize. And maybe the characters don't yet. But we recognize that was a line that was also spoke on the phone. And then there was Eve, I believe was her name. It was kind of like the nerdy housemate.
Yes.
And I think it was supposed to be the red herring that we were supposed to think that she might have been Agnes. Because one of the flashbacks they cut back to when they tell Agnes's backstory, it comes right after we see her. And it cuts right into the backstory of Agnes. So I think we were supposed to think this maybe that she is Agnes all grown up. Because at this point, Billy has escaped from the asylum. But we also know there's another killer. Because somebody's been killed in the house while Billy's been locked up. So I think that was the red herring that was supposed to be Eve. But Eve gets killed, and we know it's not her.
But see how wild this movie is? So, like, we didn't even discuss that he was institutionalized. So, as a kid, he goes through all this stuff. Then he's institutionalized. He breaks out. Then he chooses to go home, which is now the sorority house. And then there's the whole debacle with the sorority girls and trying to figure out what to do for the holidays. And then all of a sudden, Kyle comes into the picture. And he's being, like, a demanding boyfriend. And then it's just very... Oh, it's so convoluted. I wish that this film was simplified.
Well, an interesting factoid about this film, which actually might tie into the next one, is that I know there was a lot of studio involvement, especially with the Weinsteins. I know they made a lot of changes. Mm-hmm. I don't know what those changes are, but I know they were very hands-on at the studio level, so that maybe that is creating some of the issues that you have with the film. Mm-hmm. I just think it's fun. I enjoy it. I've actually watched it twice this year already.
Oh, man. All right.
I watch about a movie a day, so, you know.
No hate at all. I respect that, you know. Different strokes for different folks. But I was, you know, as much as I didn't enjoy it, I did enjoy rewatching it. I think I can agree with you. It is, even though I sound so dismal about the film, I think watching this film with friends would be a very fun and funny watch.
Yeah. A couple more little Easter eggs they have in there. The sanitarium at the beginning is the Clark Sanitarium, which is a reference to Bob Clark, the director of the original. I thought that was kind of fun.
Yeah.
And then Phil from the original movie has come back as Miss Beck.
Yeah. You know what? I thought that was her, but then I was not sure. But yeah, she's still fun in this small role. And she's good in this role.
Oh yeah, she's great. So I just think it was a fun movie. Like, I'm not saying it's on the tier of the original, but I don't think it intended to.
Yeah.
It's just a fun Christmas slasher.
Yeah. I expected more from Michelle Trachtenberg.
Yeah, and I'm wondering if they had some characters like Lacey Chabert that generally these people would be the star of their own movie. So I'm wondering if that was part of it. It's like, anyone can die. Kind of like the Janet Leigh. It's like, she can die, anyone can die. So that might have been part of the fun. Like, that's why I also think they didn't focus on any of them. I think that was part of the fun of the movies. You're supposed to kind of, you have no idea who's going to get it. No one's safe, which kind of adds to suspense in some of the scenes. But
I do just want to level things out that you did compare Psycho to Black Christmas. And I feel like that's a very strong comparison. I don't think that's a fair comparison.
Oh, no, not. Okay. I'm just saying, as far as, you know, Marion Crane dying, and she was like advertised as the star of the film, her getting killed halfway through kind of set the plane that like anyone can get it. I'm not saying they're on the same level of film, but, you know.
Sure hope not.
But anyone can die at any time, which can heightens the suspense and adds to the fun.
Yeah.
So now the final film in our discussion today is 2019's version of Black Christmas.
I am so ready to dive into this.
And I'm pretty sure me and you have different opinions on this film.
I know. I'm already prepared. But you know what? That's what makes horror great. That you can have different opinions but still respect the film.
Absolutely. So I thought we can just discuss things we liked, things we didn't like about the film.
Yeah. Do you want to give a quick synopsis?
Sure. 2019's Black Christmas, directed by Sophia Tocal, starring Imogene Poots, Alice Shannon, and Lily Donahue, featuring a guest appearance by Carrie Ells. I said that right?
Yeah.
My whole life I've been saying Eloise.
No, I think it's Ells.
You're probably right, but I'll say it wrong more than I say it right. Because
that's okay.
Yeah. So the film strays quite a bit from the original Black Christmas.
Yes.
There are similarities. It's about sorority sisters living in a sorority house, and there's a killer going around in Christmas time, and people get X'd off. So that's kind of where the similarities end.
Yeah. And then everything else is wildly different.
Yeah. And I don't think that's a bad thing. You know, sometimes if you're making a remake, especially a remake to this came out just, you know, a decade prior, Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes damned if you do, damned if you don't. If you change too much, people might hate on it. If you don't change anything, people will say, why bother?
Yeah.
So, you know, I always give it to filmmakers to kind of make it their own. So.
But that's why I do wish, I know that we're going to talk about it, but I do wish that this really was its own. I don't think it belongs in the quote unquote Black Christmas franchise because it's like, it involves the occult. It involves so many different things that the other two previous films had no relationship to at all. And it's just, even the fact that in this film as well, it doesn't really just involve one sorority house. So there are so many very strong differences. I wish it was really its own film.
Yeah, I feel like it's going to suffer the same fate, or has suffered, as Halloween 3. In essence, people went into Halloween 3 expecting to see Michael, and it was different. Halloween 3 was great, but... And I always found that people didn't give it the credit it deserved because of what they were expecting going into it.
Yeah.
So saying that, going into this film, I think people were probably not going to be happy because of how far it strayed from Black Christmas.
Yeah. Or really happy, because it is, like, for instance, so, you know, I'll say I really appreciate this film. It's not necessarily my favorite film of the holiday season or in general, but I really appreciate this film for what it is, the plots in it, the subplots in it, because there's a slight political overtone in it as well. And so I appreciate films that dive into that, and horror really by default historically does go into a lot of political realms. It's just that undertone of it. That said, like, to Doug's point, I think if you want something that is maybe a little bit more simple and really festive, that you can just really laugh at and enjoy during the holiday season, you might want to skip this film.
Yeah, I was not a fan, to put it mildly. I really disliked the movie. But I didn't hate every aspect of it. I hated most of it, I will say. Mm-hmm. But there were, you know, I'm not going to say this whole movie was crap, let's move on.
Yeah,
I like to give each filmmaker their due. And I like to call it like I see it. If I like something, I'll say it. If I don't, you know, that's the way I feel. But I think it's, before we get into that, I think we should just give a quick synopsis, since it is so different from the original Black Christmas. There's no Billy and there's no Agnes. Mm-hmm. You know, none of the characters are returning. They're all completely different. So in this story, you have your sorority sisters that are being killed off one by one by an unknown killer. And to make a long story short, it turns out that it is a fraternity that is using the magic power coming from the bust of the founder of the school to... Maybe you should describe this one.
Oh, okay. So at the crux of this film, it's about a sorority house that is kind of existing during the holiday season, but one by one, they're slowly getting picked off. And one of the sisters, Riley, starts to notice. In turn, what happens is the fraternity that belongs to, or is named after, the entire school's name, Calvin Hawthorne. It's his founding fraternity as well. It turns out that they found this like ceramic bust, and it releases this black ooze, and it's derived in the occult. And when they move it at the fraternity house, they find a spell. And with this spell, if they put this black ooze on their face, and again, we're so aware that this is a wild premise already for a not very long film. But when you put this ooze on the forehead of the men, they then have the ability to have super strength, and they then start collecting possessions from the sorority sisters. With that, they can target them and start plucking them off.
Yeah, so, and the only way to avoid the wrath of this evil fraternity is to become subservient to the men.
Yes.
So it's a pretty big separation from Billy hiding behind the wall in the original. It's, you know, we go way into the supernatural. And yeah. So,
but there are some cool Easter eggs. There are, so even though the plot is so different, there are some very cool Easter eggs that do relate to the original film.
Yeah, there were a few things. We had the plastic bag death, which was giving a gender swap. And this time, this movie, the female is killing one of the male killers with the plastic bag. So I appreciated that kill in this film.
Yeah. And then that POV shot where you see Billy in the 74 Black Christmas film, where you see his eye and it's kind of reddish, like we had mentioned earlier on, this comes back up. So whenever the fraternity brothers are possessed, their eyes turn this kind of reddish color, which is weird, but it's a nice little nod to the original film.
Right. I think I'll start with the things I liked about the movie. You know, it wasn't all terrible. Mm-hmm. The opening scene death was great. You had a girl, she gets stabbed with an icicle, kind of fitting right in with the Christmas theme or the winter theme of the movie. And then the killer drags her off camera and her body leaves the impression of a snow angel in the snow, which is pretty cool. That was the opening scene. And to be honest, I think that was the highlight of the movie for me.
I love this kill so much just because I think when you break it down, when you're a kid, like it's so often that you make snow angels and, you know, it's a really fun thing to do. So killing her where she lands in this position and is dragged off through it, there's just something very cool and dark about it. I do like the rest of the film, or again, I appreciate it, but I'm interested to hear what else you like and dislike about this film.
There is a scene when they go to the frat house and the girls are supposed to be putting on like a sexy Christmas dance. But instead, unbeknownst to the men, they change the lyrics. And the main actress, Imogen Poots' character, she is telling the story about how she was date raped by one of the men in the fraternity. So that was kind of a fun little scene.
Yeah. Very empowering scene. I loved it. They look great. I was surprised that the fraternity didn't kick them out during their song. Like, the fraternity let them just finish it, and they just kind of left on their own, which didn't entirely seem realistic, but a fun little scene that also sets the undertone, like what we were saying. So, like, in the 74 version, you had this, you know, discourse around abortion, and in this one, the discourse is around feminism and, you know, date rape and whatnot. So you see the sisters really are supporting her, which is a nice little thing in addition to just this fun little musical scene.
Yeah. And overall, I really like the look of the movie. It kind of reminds me of a more realistic lighting approach as in the original Black Christmas. The 2006 remake of Black Christmas was very Hollywood, very bright, you know, a lot of Christmas imagery, which I liked. It worked for that movie. But this one, you can tell, kind of went back to that cinematography of the first one, closer than the first remake did. So I like the look of it.
You know what I was thinking about? You know how older horror films, and I feel like certain, Disney doesn't do this, but there are certain films and TV shows now that have kind of tested using younger actors again, like actual teenagers to play teenage roles, or, you know, 20-somethings to play college students. I kind of feel like, do you feel like in the 2019 version, they look their age, or you think they look older?
They didn't, to me, they did not look like too old. You said the actress was what, 36, Imogen Poots?
Now I think so, 89. The main character who plays Riley, she was born 89. So
she was probably 29 when she filmed that movie. Because they filmed that probably 2018 or maybe early 2019. So yeah, she was almost 30.
Yeah.
But she didn't look like this was not believable to me, in my opinion. But, you know.
I agree.
So that didn't bother me. I feel like with a movie, as long as you look the role, works for me.
Yeah. Okay, so now I would love to hear, what didn't you love about this film?
Well, how much time do we have?
Oh, boy. You know what? I'm ready. I think it's good to talk about stuff like this. You can't love every film, you know? Yeah. Sometimes you've got to be rough on a film. I don't see you being too rough.
So I think the message that they're trying to convey was very important. Mm-hmm. You know, bringing attention to date rape on campus. And mm-hmm. so what I'm going to say is not me saying I'm siding with the males that this is ridiculous. I just find that for a more productive discussion to take place, there needs to be a little from both sides given. And I just find that this was so in your face that all the males in this movie were evil and all the females were victims and hated the men. I just thought there needed to be a lot more nuance. Like, I felt like the characters in the original movie had a lot more nuance, and this was just in your face to the point that there was even a scene in it when there was one male that was trying to have a discussion, kind of just saying not all men are bad, and the girl didn't want to hear it and just shouted him down. And I think that kind of delivery in a message like this actually works against the message, that it just creates shouting versus actual productive reasoning and productive discussion that could improve things. What do you think?
So I understand, but might politely, slightly disagree. And maybe this is because I am a woman, and maybe this is because, unfortunately, some of the things in this film do resonate a little bit deeper with me and some of my loved ones. But I appreciated in this film that there is one character, Landon, played by Caleb Eberhardt, and he is kind of the male hero, if we will. He is not a hero in the film, but he is someone who does fall under this occult spell and kind of breaks free and ends up helping the sorority sisters in the end. But I think that part of why maybe personally I appreciated the repetitive nature of some of the things that were said and in the way in which they were done is I think women historically and presently are so misunderstood, aren't listened to, and aren't believed. And I think that in this film, you can see even the women are arguing with themselves. They don't believe one another. And so for me, I appreciated seeing that and how by the end, there is a level of belief and understanding and, you know, support. And so I think that it felt, while the film is not realistic, I think some of the discussion points do feel and were presented quite realistically. So I did appreciate it, but I hear you. And I think that not necessarily all films do require that degree of in your face. You know, it is quite strong in this film. So I agree with you there. But yeah, I do appreciate that. But I also don't mind a little bit of politics in my film. Not always, but sometimes I think it's fun. Again, that's also why I kind of feel like this film should have been titled something totally different. I have to believe that you might still entirely dislike the film, but I think that you might feel a little bit differently if it was not within the Black Christmas franchise.
I think the first two, yeah, I completely agree with that, because the first two Black Christmas films, they're fun to watch. You know, you can really just kind of have an escape and watch this brutal Christmas film, you know.
Yeah.
And to have another film that is just, I don't know if I'm going to use the word divisive.
No, I think you can use that word. Yeah.
It just, to live in the Black Christmas world in an established franchise that people love. Mm-hmm. But then again, is it one of those cases that there was a script out there that people loved and, hey, we own the rights to Black Christmas. Why don't we just change the setting? Mm-hmm. Maybe it was one of those cases. Kind of felt that way. You know, some of the Black Christmas references felt a little shoehorned in there to keep it in the franchise, to help it be more bankable.
Yeah, I could see that. Maybe that is why there were a number of nods to the original. That could be.
Yeah. All right. So the next on my list of my dislikes, my grievances with Black Christmas 2019, it felt to me at many times like this was a film that you're watching on TV or you're watching it on an airplane that was edited and cut down. And that's because it was. This was originally shot as an R-rated movie. And after test screenings, the studio decided that we need to appeal to a female demographic. So we got to release this thing as PG-13. So cuts were made to the movie that felt jarring to me. Mm-hmm. Like there was several scenes. One, for instance, there's the dead girl in the chair and it's mm-hmm. rotating around and it cuts before you see what happened to this girl. Mm-hmm. And it didn't seem like it was done that way for artistic effect. It felt like a jarring cut. And that was probably most likely because this was had to be cut down from PG-13 and the gore had to be cut out of it, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. And one of the lines that felt really jarring was one of the sorority sisters yells, "Suck my," and they cut before she completes the sentence. I was like, why wouldn't they just have her say it? But it's because they needed to keep it PG-13. So a lot of it just felt just abruptly edited down. Some of the kills we cut before you see it happen. And let me just say, I don't think a movie needs to be rated R, a horror movie needs to be rated R. You know, mm-hmm. I'm perfectly fine seeing a PG-13 horror movie. I know a lot of people don't want to see a PG-13 horror movie. For me personally, I don't care. Like, I'm not a huge gore hound. I'm not offended by it, mm-hmm. but I don't need it. Mm-hmm. But the difference with this movie is it felt like it was hacked up.
I can maybe, you know what? I think with that, I agree. I actually was unaware of all the adjustments made to it. I would love to see what this would have looked like as an R film. Also because wasn't the original and the 2006 version, weren't they R rated?
Yes.
So I'm really surprised that this wasn't. So that's a really interesting point. And yeah, like I do understand what you're saying in terms of the hackiness. Like, I know that you and I, when we spoke offline about this, there's a particular fighting scene that is quite Lord of the Rings-esque, where the sorority sisters get to this frat house and they're fighting the fraternity brothers, and they're all using different weapons, like the paddles. Someone gets a menorah, so that shows like equality with religion and stuff, but it feels like this very funny scene that's rather it doesn't feel practical. Like, it doesn't make sense really in the seriousness of this film. So yeah, I would have really liked to have seen this as an R film. And I'm with you, I also don't require, I don't care if a film is PG or G. Like, you know, if it's in that horror science fiction world, really any film, I'm gonna watch it. Like, the rating doesn't really break the bank for me. But yeah, I know some people are, they do really care, but I think there's quality in everything that you can, regardless of ratings.
Yeah. Next on my list of grievances, I just thought the death scenes were repetitive to the point of parody. Mm-hmm. I want to say there was three, possibly four scenes when one of the sorority sisters is walking through the house and the soundtrack cuts out. And the camera pans and the killer's behind her. It's repeated several times in this movie.
But because this one has multiple killers, what would you have wanted them to do? I think that's really the only way that they could have done it. This isn't even a defense of the film. Just logically, I mean, they're all stalking them. So wouldn't they have to, like, how would you have done it?
Well, it's a slasher film, and you know, one of the staples of slasher films is kind of unique kills.
There's an archer in this film.
Yeah.
I know that you don't appreciate that also because it's quite random. Like, it doesn't make any sense as well. All of a sudden, someone just picks up archery while they're under this black ooze spell. But I did not hate the kills in this film. Anyway, so
I just thought it was very repetitive. Like, they could have done something else. Mm-hmm. I think as a horror movie, it didn't work. And I think for the last two reasons I gave is why I felt it doesn't work as a horror movie.
Okay.
Yeah. And there was one scene in this movie that just drove me crazy, almost to the point I wanted to turn it off. So there's a car ride. It's the main character and her friend.
Uh-huh.
And they are pretty much spelling out what we just saw in the movie. So you're saying that the men are evil because of the ooze that's coming out of the statue. It's like they're literally telling you the movie. Like, you could turn the movie on at that scene and not even see the first hour and be all caught up. Like, that just felt like an insult to an audience member. Like, they're literally spelling this movie out. It was such expository dialogue, but we just saw this. You don't need to remind us.
Yeah. And to circle back, I think that's where you're seeing that the women don't believe the women as well, which I, in my brain, hypothetically, I think maybe that's why it was in there. However, I totally agree. This was an unnecessary scene. It was also quite lengthy for a car drive, like with the amount that was discussed. And then also Riley, she's upset that she's not believed and she just gets out of the car and they're still being chased. And like, it just doesn't make any sense. So I totally agree with you there.
It was a long scene because they had to get every beat from the movie into that dialogue just in case someone happened to use the bathroom to catch them up. Okay. What they missed while they were out.
That's true. I'm really disappointed that we didn't have a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle pop out from all the ooze that was expelled in this film. I'm so disappointed.
Or like the ooze falls on a rat and then he turns into a giant, you know, mutant
killer. Yeah, he could have been a killer. It would have been great.
It wouldn't seem out of place in this movie.
Yeah.
So there's another spot that in this ending that we're supposed to cheer and enjoy that also felt really off to me. So we saw that while this ooze was on the men, they were evil. But once the ooze comes off of them, they're back to normal. So while this fire is raging in this house, the ooze comes off of some of the fraternity brothers. And so now they're normal. But are we supposed to still cheer that these men, these you know, young college students are being burned in this fire?
Well, because some of them are inherently bad. Or have bad intentions, which we do see in the film with a few of them. So I think it's a generalized, I understand your point, but it's a generalized statement, kind of. That's why Landon survives, because he's not like them.
Someone's going to have to call all these parents to all these college students that say, sorry, your son's not coming home because he was burned alive in a fire. But it's okay, because the girls were celebrating. It's fine.
Yeah, I'm kind of annoyed. Like, in the moment watching it, I always appreciate when someone makes or throws like a Molotov cocktail, you know, and starts a fire in a form of resistance. That said, all of the damage, if you have not seen the film and are still planning to watch it, you'll notice all of the damage has been done. Like, plenty of people at this fraternity now have been, it's like a massacre in there. So it's whoever is left. And then, what was the character's name? Not Christy. But anyway, Riley's friend, who is like the co-star, she all of a sudden grabs this vase and throws it at the professor, who's actually leading the fraternity in all of this. And she has her own issues with him. And she just throws it at him. And it just gets out of control so quickly, and it just seems also unnecessary. I kind of like this scene, but it is ultimately, I feel, unnecessary. It didn't have to be in there. And again, kind of weird. You just had a whole entire massacre. They're going to know that you burned this down, whether in self-defense or not. Like, just, I don't know, just maybe just kill everyone else, because now it's a lot of damage collectively.
And unfortunately, all the surviving girls, after they're celebrating that they overcame the evil, they're all going to prison. Because the cops are going to show up and they just burn the house down with all these students and teachers in it. And what are they going to do? Tell the cops that they were evil from ooze from a statue? They're going to be like, in the car, ladies.
Well, there's only the one cop on campus and he ends up getting killed.
Well, someone's showing up. Someone's responding to that fire. And those girls are going to, unfortunately, spend Christmas behind bars.
We'll see. I mean, the other thing that is I kind of appreciate here, but again, it's so different from the other two films, is what you end up learning by the end of the film is this isn't the only sorority house that's being targeted. It turns out it's all the sorority houses on campus. So they kind of, whoever has survived the other sorority house situations, they end up combining forces and end up fighting this. So like, they do have a whole entire array of people who can back up the violence. That said, it's just Again, I kind of like it, but I understand why you and others may not really enjoy this film.
See, this is good. This shows what we learned from the Scarcity of Horror podcast. You're actually the first person I ever spoke to about this movie that's liked it. But that's good. Sometimes it's good to speak to people that don't have the same opinion as you. And that's how we learn. That's how we improve as a society.
That's right. That is how we improve. Well said, Doug. Good job.
Yeah. So this is good. You know, I still dislike it, but I appreciate that you enjoy it. And I'm glad you enjoy the film. I won't be returning till 2019's Black Christmas. But I'm glad you like it. And there's others out there that like it. My only drawback in saying that, though, is that I fear that this damaged the franchise, that we may not get any more Black Christmas movies for quite a while, because I know this was not very well received in the masses.
I mean, we might not, but we might also just get a sequel, I think, down the line. But look at how much time passed between the first one and the second one. You know, that was
33 years. Yeah.
Yeah, so even if there's time that passes, I think you'll always have a market for a film like this. I could definitely see them doing, and I don't want them to do another one. I just feel like leave the franchise alone. Like, stop sequeling everything, stop remaking everything, just leave them. And if you really, in your desire to really remake a film, I don't know. That's why I like that it's so different, but then call it something different. And just when you're in interviews, say like, hey, I was so inspired by this film. This is my iteration of this, you know, but yeah, I would be fine if they left this franchise alone.
If there were to be another one, would you rather see another retelling or another vision of the original story with Billy and Agnes? Or would you rather see kind of Black Christmas become an anthology and each one kind of is its own story?
I really don't want another one, period. But I suppose if you're like, you have to choose or something terrible is going to happen, I think I would rather go back to a Billy Agnes storyline, just because, again, to me, this doesn't even feel like a Black Christmas film based on the other two. And I will never watch the 2006 version again. I'm so content with the couple of times I've seen it. I don't ever need to rewatch that one, but yeah, I think I really like the Billy Agnes storyline. So I might be down for a prequel. I'm not always against prequels, but if they were to do a prequel that takes place before the 74 version and kind of gives you a little bit more insight and doesn't cheapen it by saying he's institutionalized or anything like that, like it's just how kind of Billy Agnes, how it comes to be, or maybe how he ends up in the house that night, I would be down with a film like that.
Okay.
What would you rather have?
Good question. I think I'm on the vein of you. I kind of don't want it to go the anthology route. I don't know. It's a good question. I think we may need to have some time to pass for another generation before we go back to this story. You know, it would be a prequel to the original. So here's the thing. I didn't mind the backstory in the 2006 version because that was its own version of the movies. Problem is, when you do a backstory to the original, then that could anger some of the fans because they may make changes that could affect the way you look at the original movie.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So I think another generation could pass, and I wouldn't mind a modern retelling of it.
Yeah.
You know, I just think Billy, sometimes we don't need to know why someone's crazy. Might
or
be
why
scarier.
Someone is so yellow.
What's that?
Or why someone is so wildly yellow.
Yeah. So I don't know. It's very endearing. It's interesting. A lot of the other franchises, you know, as Michael Myers and they all progressed, when we start getting backstories, sometimes it does negatively affect your vision of the first one. Like Halloween 6, we find out that there was a constellation of stars that appear on Halloween night. And when it appears, he appears. I think sometimes that lessens the original.
Yeah.
His motives. I think sometimes it's better here's Billy. He's a crazy man and he's living in your attic. That might be scarier than any backstory they can give him.
So to piggyback off this topic, would you rather have no remakes? So we would only have the 74 version, no 2006, no 2019, or would you keep both that we currently have?
Oh, so if I wanted to get rid of 2019, I would also lose 2006?
Yeah.
No, I wouldn't do that because I enjoyed 2006 and I did not like 2019 whatsoever, but I just don't need to watch it. Okay. You know what I mean? I don't need to watch the movie. Someone else could enjoy it. I'll have my 2006. So I wouldn't want to cut off your nose to spite your face.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How about you?
Yeah, I would have them just exist at this point. I think the damage has been done, so it's fine. You know, and again, like, I think when I speak to someone like you and other friends as well who are into these films, hearing how much joy, how fun you thought the film was, like, for 2006, whether I liked it or not, I think that's still important that it did give you joy. Like, I'm sure the people who made the film had so much fun making it. And there are plenty of people who like the films and also dislike films, but in a fun way. Like, I didn't love 2006, right? I'm content never watching it again. If a friend invited me over and was like, do you want to hate watch this film? Oh, hell yeah. I'm going to want to hate watch that film. So, you know, I think they serve a purpose in the world.
Yeah, absolutely. Then what we just reiterate what we said earlier, the big problem is that it's called Black Christmas, because if this was called something else, yeah, it wouldn't offend people that loved the original or loved 2006. And I think by naming it Black Christmas may have put a target on their back, mm-hmm, which might have heightened the criticism that the movie had. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. But I understand why they may have done that. You know, I'm sure you have a built-in audience by calling it a remake. You have fans of the original, fans of the 2006 that, you know, it's a proven property that might check it out because of the name, but yeah.
You're also going to have people who wanted to check out this film or checked it out because of Blumhouse. And regardless of how we might feel, I have already mentioned this, that I, again, really appreciate Blumhouse. And I think that they have amazing concepts separate from the remakes. I don't love their execution, I have found a lot of the time, but I maybe think that you would have also enjoyed this film if it wasn't from their line as well. That's a possibility for sure.
Yeah. One thing I will say, though, is that no longer is Halloween Ends my least favorite franchise capper.
Yeah, I will disagree with you there wholeheartedly, but I know that you have such strong opinions about that. And I do too. I do not disagree with you about that film, but yeah, I could watch this film all day long and really never watch Halloween Ends ever again. And I like, actually really crushes me to say that, because I was excited for that film and it's really a downer.
Yeah. See, that shows the passion of these movies. We love these movies. We're not going into it to dislike. We want to like these movies, and it's almost a disappointment we get.
Yeah.
When it's not good. You know, like, I don't think anyone, we don't go to a movie to not like it. We want to enjoy ourselves. So it's really a disappointment when it's a franchise that you love and, you know, it's a beloved story and you leave the theater brokenhearted.
Yeah. And you have to, like, pluck little instances to save it in your mind palace, like, well, that part was okay, so I guess it's not the worst film ever. Like, you know, it's when you're so excited for a film, you've been waiting, and it's just not at all what you thought it would be. But, you know, again, I'm sure that there are plenty of people who love Halloween Ends, and that's okay. Not me, but that's okay.
It's okay, you know, it's not every movie's for everybody.
Yeah.
Well, that concludes our review of the three Black Christmas films.
What a lovely, bloody good time.
This was a very interesting discussion. It was a lot deeper than I anticipated going into these movies.
Same. I love this. I thought it was so fun. I really, you know, I was not, while I assumed that we would probably disagree a bit on 2006, I am also maybe pleasantly surprised hearing how much you do enjoy it, just because for me, that's so not how I felt. But it was nice hearing kind of the passion come from you, how much you did kind of enjoy it. So yeah, this was really fun.
Absolutely. So we've already done our 13 questions with you last week. So we have a new segment. It's a trivia segment.
Oh, no. Oh, no. All right.
All right. So the way this game works, I will tell you the year the movie came out. I'm going to poorly describe the movie.
Okay. And they are not necessarily a Christmas horror film. It's just a horror film. A
horror film, correct? That came out in December.
Okay.
And then I'll keep giving you more clues until you can guess the movie.
Oh, no. Maybe let's cap it at like 3 clues, because then I'm going to start having anxiety.
So this movie came out in 1973 in December. It's about a single mother raising her daughter who gets sick.
Ugh. Her daughter who gets... Oh, The Exorcist?
You got it. Wow.
Yeah.
That was great.
I was going to say Cujo, and then you said daughter, and I was like, not Cujo.
This film came out in 1996. It was about a girl who was 1 year removed from losing her mother.
Oh, I have no idea.
This movie dissects the horror genre.
Okay. 96. No, still, I know I'm going to know. I'm going to be annoyed.
This movie bucks the trend of having one killer, but this film has two.
Wait, I do know this film. I'm going to say I give up.
How about one more clue? This movie starts with an ominous phone call.
Oh, When a Stranger Calls? No. Not, no, okay. So one more clue then.
The killers in these movies wore a mask with the face of a ghost.
Oh, wait, Scream?
Ding, 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 you got it!
Oh my God. Oh, I'm an abomination. Okay, wow.
It's been a while since that came out.
I'm going to melt onto the floor now. Ay, ay, ay. Okay.
This movie was from 1983 and was about a boy who fixes the car.
Christine?
You got it.
Oh, my. Oh,
you're good. You know what you're talking about.
That's because you felt bad for me with the last one.
This movie is from 1941 and is about a man who grows a lot of hair.
The werewolf? Or Jekyll and Hyde?
The Wolfman, you got it. Wolfman, we'll give it to you.
Ding, ding, yeah, ding, okay. Ding, ding. Thank you.
Yeah. A couple more December releases. I'll just tell you what they are. Hellbound, Hellraiser 2 in 1988. Scream 2 in 97. The Faculty, 98. The Orphanage in 2007. Wolf Creek in 2005. And not horror, but it's related, King Kong in 2005. So there are horror movies in December that aren't Christmas related.
I'm so surprised that Scream and Scream 2 came out this time and not before Halloween.
Yeah. First two, they were kind of December staples.
Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. Hmm.
Fun films. I guess it's a fun time to watch it, but yeah, I am surprised. Maybe just because it's kind of also like, maybe because kids are going on break. So, I don't know. But anyway, those were great.
Yeah. Cool. Well, that wraps up for this episode. You sure you want to come back next week after today's episode?
Yes. I always want to come back. I always learn something, actually, from, you know, both being on the show and listening in. I was telling Doug right before we started recording that actually the Thanksgiving episode, I had never heard of the film Christie that Fred had recommended, and I watched it also, and I loved it. I thought it was such a unique really fun, fast-paced film. So yeah, of course, I will always want to come back.
We are here to entertain and to educate. Yeah, check back next week to learn more interesting horror facts and to find out. Woo! We are going to continue our Christmas coverage with part 3 of the Scared Stiff Christmas special. So be sure to tune in.
Thanks, guys.
Again, where can we find you on the social medias?
You can find me on Instagram at ghoulwhip, G-H-O-U-L underscore W-H-I-P.
Excellent. You can follow us on our Instagram at scared underscore stiff underscore films. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next week for part 3 of the Christmas special. Take care, guys.
Bye, guys.